Malcolm Honlein is with us, Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. We call this the weekly update at JM in the AM. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Boker Tov to you.
All right, I'll start locally because there's just too many people contacting me about getting your assessment about this. Here in the New Jersey area, there have been multiple what are being called drone sightings, and there have even been reports that these drones are being sent and controlled by the Iranian government, and frankly, a lot of other theories have been bandied about as well. Your reaction to this somewhat of a panic-filled news story?
Well, what is most amazing is the inability of the any of the defense forces and capacities that we have to identify the source, the nature, and the danger posed by these drones. There is no question that exists. This is not a UFO situation. Unidentified flying object. These are have been seen, pictured, reported. Even as far as Ramstedt Base in Germany is reporting that the drones were flown over there, the base itself. And we don't know how many more there are, but the reports have sometimes come up to as many as 30 located in one area. I think that the story of a mothership from Iran and being launched has not been substantiated.
But what's the likelihood, in your opinion?
It's hard to see how they had the capacity to do this. They have retrofitted some boats, but they did it to accommodate new missiles that they have, as opposed to anybody having seen them preparing it for to be able to carry massive numbers of drones. They have massive numbers. They've been selling them to Russia. They have developed that technology. As you know, they don't have an air force, so they rely on their missiles and the drones, as we saw in the attacks on Israel, as what they have provided to their allies in Yemen. And those have flown the whole distance from Yemen, and repeatedly, even this past week, the one that hit in Yavne came from Yemen. So they obviously have developed means of preventive detection.
So the Yavne attack was essentially a Houthi attack, right? That's how we would classify it.
Absolutely, and I would fully anticipate that at some point Israel will have to take action, because clearly the West is not, despite the fact that they're still attacking shipping, that they are still posing a danger to the international economy by virtue of the fact that prices can go up 10-15% on products because of the interference and because of the longer route that products have to take and have to have the capacity to survive, you know, to be remain fresh with its produce.
Last week I said that they were, you know, trying to make a final statement before what happened in Syria, meaning the Houthis. But the reality is what? That they're especially with this week's attack, they're trying to prove that even if their sponsor is depleted, or even if their sponsor is, you know, on its heels, Iran, obviously, I'm referring to, nonetheless, they're still active in the terror game. I mean, is that what they're trying to prove?
I do think that they're trying to prove that that front is still an active one, and that they, despite the bombing attacks against them, and I think that there has to be a decision by the United States in particular, but by others as well, the Brits and others who have participated, that we have to eliminate this danger. We've proven now, Israel has shown them how to do it, what can be done. They themselves went to Yemen and bombed the ports and repeatedly did so. I think that it's not an easy attack. It's a long distance to fly and to go undetected and to be able to carry out the kind of attack that is necessary. You also need the bombs. And as you saw in Syria this week, Israel used a tremendous amount of munitions, and they still do not have an open channel to all the munitions that they need.
That's unbelievable.
But clearly, clearly they had supplies that were utilized when you have hundreds of raids, and I believe that it's a mistake for Israel to continue to announce and proclaim, you know, that they're up to almost 500 attacks in the latest report.
Yeah, I mean, and we'll get to Syria in a second, because obviously it's the headline of the week. But I mean, I don't know if Israel has a choice, frankly, because of the way that information flows around the world at the moment. And we will get back to that in a second. I just want to ask you one other thing locally. There is a report, a post these days. Who knows if it could be trusted or not? But I found it fascinating just in terms of analysis that I'm going to ask you. The NYPD confirms supposedly that they're actively arresting anti-Israel protesters at NYU who set up a blockade outside the library calling for NYU to, quote, divest from death. NYU faculty and staff for, quote, justice in Palestine claims that at least two faculty members are among those arrested. Now, on the assumption that it's true, and by the way, if you know it's true, let me know, but on the assumption for a moment that it's true, is this the nature of the episode, that it was so egregious that the NYPD finally had to take action? Or do you think this is a significant shift? I don't want to call it the Trump effect, but it might be a coincidence. A significant shift, and the NYPD and other police forces around the country are going to regard these types of activities differently than they've done in recent months.
So there's several questions there. One, I don't know that we can say it's a change in policy as yet. We have seen it on some campuses. As you know, the people at NCRI, the Network Contagion Research Institute, put out a report on DEI, and the reaction around the country has been explosive, and I'll tell you the connection in 1 second. This report from Walmart to the University of Michigan dropped their DEI plans, are in the process of revising them, revisiting them, because I think the institutions have come to realize that it's not just Jewish students who are paying a price or other minorities. It is the universities themselves, and are going through this process, and I think are anticipating what the Trump administration will do in their promise to enforce Title VI and to go after the universities for their actions. The new leader of the Senate, the 2B, Senator Thune, has made it clear. The leader of the House, Johnson, has made it clear they are trying to push the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act and the other measures that would hold universities to greater account, as well as others. And I'm not sure that they will get them passed this session, but hopefully in the new session they will be able to move it through the Senate. The House has approved these measures. So the universities see themselves facing multiple pressures. One is the donors. One is the life on campus itself becoming intolerable. And when you block entrances to institutions, that has become a red line for many of them. And yet, on the other hand, we have seen that the demonstrations in many of the places are diminished. The numbers are less than they were. It's winter, perhaps, and maybe there are other reasons for it. It is not dead. They are still getting funding from the sources, the foreign sources and domestic sources. And I think that you can't draw conclusions at this point, and that's why the pressure has to be kept up. The lawsuits that are being brought against dozens of universities and people are rallying to fund them now to a greater degree. They understand that this is the leverage we have, both for disclosure and because the universities respond to this pressure, and it forces disclosure. It forces a lot of stuff that would not happen otherwise in terms of transparency, which universities all call for and demand, and they yell about what the American government does or Israel. But they themselves are not transparent, neither about the sources of funding, reporting them honestly, or about their policies in dealing with these assaults.
All right. Still, what a difference a year makes, huh?
It can be right, but it continues, and we'll have to see. And it's only by implementation. And I think the people who have been appointed so far are people who will want to implement the policies, but we don't know yet how the education department will be. They want to dismantle it, but we need the enforcement. We need to see the states pick up the enforcement then, and some governors now are talking more tough about it. But too many of them have been silent, including in New York State.
Well, if certain university presidents would have had some vision on this issue, they'd still have their jobs, frankly. But what a difference a year makes. Unbelievable. All right, back to where I interrupted you regarding Syria, and we'll work our way backwards for a second because you brought up this point. I mean, do you agree or not? It seems that, and I'm using this as an example, obviously. It could be anywhere in the world. It could be any force in the world. It seems that if Israel, goes and takes out an arms depot, 300 kilometers from the Syrian-Israeli border, and does so, under the blanket of darkness, that 10 seconds later, there's a video of it going around the world. So isn't that one of the factors, as much as you and many others would really appreciate and like, if Israel could keep all of this secretive? It seems almost impossible these days.
Well, it's two different things, I think, to a degree. One is those pictures are often taken by Syrian and other sources of the attacks. You don't have Israelis on the ground there taking local photographs, but a lot of it can be seen from the Golan Heights and from other areas when they're in that region. But what I was referring to more was this. One upsmanship, it seems, that everybody has to the Navy says, we destroyed the Navy. The Air Force says, you destroyed the Navy. You should see what we did to the Air Force. then they come back and say, Air Force, are you kidding? We knocked out every ship, 86% of Syria's capacity is gone. But it's not a laughing matter, in fact, because this feeds the International Criminal Court. This feeds the others that they come back and that France has said, that they have to stop. Others have said they want them out of the even the language you use when you say we seized, which was the term repeatedly used, at least in translation, the buffer zone. We didn't seize it. We went in to protect the UNIFIL troops. They were under attack. They couldn't protect themselves. So Israel went in to protect them and the Druze communities, and certainly has no intention of seizing land. This is a no man's land. It's been so for many years. There's no real benefit to be there except for defensive purposes. And the same thing on the Hermon. It's Israel's ability now to put at the top of Mount Hermon observation capacity, because, otherwise they were blinded by the Mount Hermon, blinded the ability to see attacks coming from that side. So this is a purely defensive measure, but it's not the way, it's being portrayed. Right. I'm saying the Hermon. Right. The attacks on, and by the way, on the thing took out on the Navy and the others. This stuff falling in the hands of jihadi groups, which these groups are, and they're being painted as, reformists, etc. There's no evidence that that's the case yet. And then having that capacity, Israel took out the Air Force. They left the MiG-35s and advanced jets right there for the grabbing. It would have been another Afghanistan where you would have had all of this huge capacity falling into the hands of these groups. So, and you see even that citizens went in and raided the places and took rifles and couldn't take this heavy equipment because they don't know how to use it. But it's a very serious matter, and it shows you also how much they had. And they never used it. They never took a plane off the ground. They never used the tanks. Israel, in fact, has a couple of the tanks, of the Syrian tanks that they captured. And certainly other forces. And you see the rebels of various kinds there. And you still have a strong Iranian presence. Still have the presence of Turkey, and they're the big victors in this, having backed the HTS. As opposed to Iran, which lost a huge investment there, as they did on two other fronts. So their alliance of resistance is falling apart and collapsing. And now's the time we should be hitting Iran. This is the time we should be getting the people in Iran to stand up to show that this is a paper tiger.
Wow, you gave us a lot there to unpack. On the first thing, by the way, with the comparison to Afghanistan, it's really all about geography. When you're 8,000 miles away, nobody cares. I shouldn't say nobody cares. They're not as concerned about leaving weaponry in the hands of rebel groups and terrorists. And obviously when it's next door, like in Israel's case, they're going to go in and make sure that they don't have the capability of having anything that could harm Israeli citizens and civilians. So that's one difference. The other thing is you just listed, you know, winners and losers, and it looks like Turkey, as you just said, is quote-unquote a winner, whatever that means in this case, and Iran is obviously a loser. Where do you put Russia in this? Where do you put China in this? Which side of the ledger do they go on?
These are good questions, but let me just go back in the sense of what I said. You're right about the proximity issue, right, that people don't know that Afghanistan really exists. And, you know, they don't know if they're cartoon characters or there's a real country anymore or whatever.
Right.
But, you know, one of the, it is a proximity danger because the weapons that were captured, Iran has been reverse engineering them. So they got a lot of the equipment, and they are able then to replicate it because they reverse engineer it. And all of our secret stuff that we left behind there, $80 billion in equipment. So you can say it was distance and maybe they couldn't have shipped it out. They could have shipped it out. The Russians have ships off the coast of their base in Tartus. They brought merchant ships and others to take out equipment from Syria so as not to leave behind. They still hold their base, and they want to. This is their warm water base that they've aspired to for hundreds of years or centuries, and now they thought that they would lose it completely. It would be a humiliation for Russia, which is still trying to be relevant there. But you have this tripartite competition between Russia, Iran, and Turkey that I've talked about for a long time. And in this case, Turkey operating against the PKK and having established itself in the northeast area proves that that was a winning decision, because they can kill at will. So can the others, Iran, Russia, any of them, as long as they're not Jews, as long as they're not Israelis. The world doesn't care, and nobody's holding them to account. You don't see the International Criminal Court. they'll go against Assad because it's an easy target. So one thing is that the distance is not the answer here, that it's neglect. And and the Russians showed what should be done. And Israel made sure the other way it could be done, which is you destroy everything on the ground if you can't move it out.
Yeah.
And they're still, by the way, moving out stuff from in Lebanon. They uncovered in one place a 3.5-kilometer tunnel going in from Lebanon into Syria. They found inside a church an entrance into a tunnel. They took 3 trucks loads of the armaments out of that one place, 3 truckloads, and then they have to blow up the rest because they can't take everything out that is found. So, okay, now to your question about where Russia comes out. Russia right now has not had a winning streak, and it's sort of the Mets and the Chinese don't invest in this way. China goes in for its own interests, and you know, they didn't make a big investment in Syria as they don't elsewhere. What they do is they go into countries, they rape them, they take out whatever they can in terms of energy, which they will buy or get, but also, as they do in Africa, they do in Asia, they buy huge swaths of land, they grow food, everything gets taken out back to China. China's investment with these guys was more in what's happening in the Red Sea area and the Road and Belt, which is not impacted directly because Syria wasn't directly involved. So China has a lot of internal economic problems, very severe. It's an opportunity to have more leverage on them, and also the role in supporting Hamas and supporting Iran and supporting others. We should be pressuring them, and I hope that President Trump will do more in that regard. And the Iranians, who are the big losers in all of this. It's time that we use maximum pressure. And the fact that we released $6 billion more to them in the last week secretly, waived sanctions against them, supposedly to let Iraq pay for electric bills, is we learned nothing from the past experiences in this regard. So Turkey, Iran would be much more vulnerable now. The internal situation, their people know about it. They're humiliated by the failure of Iran pouring billions and billions of dollars into Lebanon and into Syria. This makes them vulnerable. And we don't see the West showing determination and commitment and standing with the people, not invading Iran, but supporting the people in Iran. So there are winners and losers, but some of it will not be determined until the longer range. Will Russia be able to hold on to its base? Will it be held to account for its support for Assad and for many years? Will be determined. But the tripartite conflict between the three occupying countries until now, Turkey, Iran, and Russia, Turkey clearly in this most strong position. How do they have that capacity sitting in Idlib to have convoys of a mile long of military vehicles on the first day running into the cities and that they took over into Aleppo and into Hama? Turkey has been training them. Turkey has been arming them. This stuff doesn't come in a shamayim. It's, I don't know why there isn't more assessment and discussion. Where did they train? How did they get to this ability? It's true the Syrian soldiers have just abandoned their things and thousands fled into Iraq. They tried to flee into Lebanon. They abandoned their posts and now they're going to be hunted down. And you see that they're killing people at will. In anybody seen as a collaborator with Assad gets separated from his head.
JM in the AM, Malcolm Homeline with us. Weekly update reminder, if you find yourself enjoying and becoming more informed because of segments like this, make sure to support our year-end campaign, fjbunity.org, fjbunity.org. By the way, in there you mentioned the, that if it was, as long as it's not Israelis, nobody cares and nobody condemns. I had the opportunity this week to eavesdrop on a Zoom union meeting, a New York City union, and they opened the floor for potential resolutions. And of course, the first person stands up and says, because it was in person and Zoom, first person stands up and says, we must condemn the genocide in Gaza. There are 400 school, this is the teachers' union, there's 400 school teachers there that have been killed and nobody cares about them. And I'm saying to myself, my God, have they ever brought up in the past the school teachers who were in countries like Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, or anywhere else to make a resolution in solidarity with that brotherhood and sisterhood? And of course, only because it's Israel and Gaza in this case, was there even any attention paid to it at all? Just wanted to mention that, because sometimes listening to things like that becomes very frustrating, frankly.
But you're raising something very important that people still don't listen. If I spoke about this in the past weeks, and especially after the summer, because of the study that same group, NCRI, did about the K-12 and showing the infiltration and the role of the teachers' unions against Jewish faculty and not defending them, but in many cases, joining the efforts to make it a hostile environment. And you're right, there are minutes of these meetings. There are the curricular development that they have that is absolutely hostile to Israel being implemented across the country. New York is one of the worst, but the UFT, NEA, all these groups have been complicit in it. And more information is available, but people can go to their site, read what's going on in K-12, that Jewish teachers are being forced out and Jewish students are being forced out of public schools across the country.
Unbelievable. All right, back to Syria for a second. Excuse me. When someone is a dictator and has a stronghold on a country for 50 plus years, how does one explain the speed with which his demise arrived? Or this has been, an ongoing process for, I don't know, years or decades, and it finally culminated this past weekend. How do you explain the speed of this entire episode versus Assad?
Well, I've gotten a lot of questions this week about it, because trying to explain Assad, as you know, I met with him. I met him in Damascus. I spent over 3 hours alone with him, so there aren't many people who had that exposure to him. People want to know about him, and he told me a great deal about himself. That's for another program, because it'll eat up the rest of his time. But he did not do anything to really build a broad-based support. He suppressed the people. He had prisons, and you see all of the families crying because their loved ones were incinerated and destroyed, and no trace of them, and they thought they were under the prisons, you know, huge holding cells, and they come there, and they find they're not there because the people were eliminated. And he had a massive security system. You know, when I went there, I drove in, you know, he sent cars, and I had police protection. But when we got to the place, I was alone. We drove up to the palace. Not a single guard was visible. And as Bibi said to me afterwards, he said, every tree was a guard. But I sat alone with him in the palace. There was nobody. They didn't even bring a glass of water. There was nobody there. I mean, it could have been anything. And so my sense is, first of all, he did not anticipate becoming the leader. It was his brother who was supposed to have got killed in a car accident. We don't know if it was an accident, but at least got killed in Lebanon in a car accident, the speeding. And he was an ophthalmologist thrust into this position. And in the course of the discussion, by the second hour, he started telling me intimate things about his family and about other things. He did things more than they'd say publicly, but he did not build a loyalty. It was all by fear and oppression, and you know he couldn't even trust the people under him.
Interesting.
So when it came down to the wire, I'm not sure he was being told the truth about the nature of the assault,
right.
And that fact that with all of the money they spent, with all of the equipment they had, there was nobody manning it. I mean, they couldn't have taken on these guys when they started out of Idlib and destroyed them. Had they used the resources available to them, it would not have gone further. People would have taken to the streets. You could have had some uprising, but they had the capacity to go after them because they were doing it.
So even dictators need to be politically astute.
They have to be astute. They have to understand where their interests lie. They have to understand how you know, there's a limit to how much you can suppress people. And unless you have, like Russia, Putin arrests people and, you know, he has to worry about it. Every dictator has to worry about it. And you need to build and invest more and more in your suppression mechanisms as people get more frustrated, more tired, and then eventually they erupt. But it can erupt from a group like this, which was a terrorist entity. These were ISIS and Al-Qaeda before. And, you know, they might have put on a suit that doesn't change who they are or what they believe.
Why are they reaching out to Israel? Why, among the first reports that we got Saturday night, Sunday, out of Syria, was the overture from the Al-Qaeda, we'll call them for a moment, leaders to Israel for some type of, I don't know, peace agreement or peace moving forward?
Well, I'm not sure that that's what they were reaching out for. I think, number one, they want to neutralize Israel because it's the only power in the region that will actually act against them and could defend the Druze communities in along the Golan and elsewhere. That, Israel was within 20 kilometers of Damascus. It's not far distances. People should just look at the map and understand what distances are involved here. So they were trying, I think, to neutralize Israel, keep it out, you know, throw out these things. But, you know, it's a long distance, believe me, a very long distance between that and actually wanting to have peace or being willing to sign an agreement. I think they are trying to indicate that they're not going to attack Israel because they didn't want another front. They had to try to consolidate their positions in the cities they took. They never anticipated, I think, that they could move so quickly that in 3 days, you know, you conquer Aleppo, Hamas. It's just unbelievable. Nobody could have believed it.
Well, thank God we have a prime minister that's not distracted by anything else at the moment and can give his full concentration to these types of issues. Thank God.
And doesn't listen to don't, because if they did every don't, none of this. And then, you know, for the president to take credit, they supported Israel. We have a lot to be thankful for. But to say that they're responsible for it, that when in fact they try to hold back a lot of things that led to this, what they did in Lebanon, what they did in Gaza, what they did, you know, and Iraq also now. Right. It's another one of the legs of the resistance thing. The situation is in flux there as well.
Did you not get my sarcasm about the distracted prime minister?
I did.
Oh, you did.
I was trying not to
not to acknowledge it. Yeah, for those of you wondering, a lot of people in Israel think it's a good time for a prime minister trial, if you're following the news closely this week. Malcolm, speaking of, I don't remember what you just said. You said something about flights that jogged my memory. Is the flight from Israel to Iran much shorter now that it seems that Israel might have more of an option to use Syrian airspace?
It's a factor, but Israel is trying not to provoke but they took the, precautionary measures to destroy 86% or more than 80% of their capacity, and including all of the S-300, which is a Russian-supplied anti-aircraft, which has proven both in Iran and Syria not to be that effective, I think. But it's still a lethal weapon, and to take out so much of the infrastructure that threatened Israel and that was never fully utilized. There are people now saying that Assad had a quiet understanding with Israel or allowed a lot of the attacks because it served their purpose as well. To go on, but the you're raising an important point about what this does to shift the overall balance and the options available. And there's a lot of pressure in Israel to go after Iran and not to wait and to do it before the new president is in place, but who would support. And they're talking about the Trump administration officials considering strikes at Israel, at Iran's nuclear capacity and the nuclear weapons before they're produced. It's essential that we do it now because they're going to move ahead more and more. If they don't invest in these other countries, in Gaza, in Lebanon, and elsewhere, then they will do it domestically. But it's the time for us to encourage the people of Iran to stand up against their government and do the same thing and invoke not terrorist organizations, but the people, and create a new kind of Iran, reminiscent of the past.
Do you believe the Iranians when they say they're more open now to nuclear inspections?
I do not believe that they will allow true nuclear inspections. Every time they do this, it's a game they play because there's a resolution introduced by France, Germany, and Britain against them at the IAEA that because and the head Grassi seems to be weak-kneed again now. He wasn't in the beginning, but we're not seeing the same kind of resoluteness coming out of there. There has to be clear determination. It's a time to break the knees there and to go after their nuclear program. And if they don't do it, to find ways to make sure that it's done. That they're getting Sukhoi 35 jets from Russia now that will give them new capacities. And they have, they're very smart. They're Iranian people. Their engineers and scientists are developing new equipment and capacity. And they are moving ahead with enrichment. So now's the time for us. Instead of releasing money to them, we should be breaking them, their economy, enforcing the sanctions, going after China for buying the oil, 85% of it, and anybody else that is aiding and abetting the Iranian regime.
Finally, Malcolm, and probably the most important thing, are you endorsing the optimism that Jake Sullivan is projecting regarding an imminent, quote-unquote, hostage deal?
We can never say it's imminent because we're dealing with people who do not care. They're inhuman. They collected the information and supposedly turned it over about them. They keep hiding behind the fact that they don't control all of the hostages, but other groups like Pidge in Gaza have them. So, and we don't know how many are alive. We don't know their conditions. And whatever can be done, we have to get them out. But I think that, this pressure now, And I think that President Trump's warning and the concerted efforts that are being made hopefully will yield at least the initial agreement, and then a second, maybe it'll have to be in two stages. But you can't trust anything that Hamas says. Their leadership structures, has been decimated like Hezbollah's. But that's the time that we ought to be putting the pressure on them, and they should get the message that Israel is going to get all the weapons they need and the support that they need, rather than, you know, prosecution and thinking that Israel will be intimidated. And by the way, look at the courage of the president of Paraguay, goes to Israel, announces that he's opening his embassy in Jerusalem. Look at the accounts, you know, how Milei of Argentina is standing by Israel. The hopeful signs that governments that are very hostile Israel will be replaced in various parts of the world, that the including in the horrific conditions that exist in Canada, and their current Prime Minister Trudeau will hopefully not have a long-term contract. But there is positive information: economic growth 3.5%, despite the war, despite everything, and the fifth happiest people in the world, Israelis. People, don't dismiss it. Don't get caught up just because, you know, we focus on some of the statistics and talking about what's going on. And the second half, don't ignore what we're seeing in terms of the anti-Semitism. Look at Canada. Look at source, because sometimes people have greater clarity when they look at other places for what's happening. But it's here as well, in the same virility and the same hostility exists here. And we have to keep the pressure on and keep it on Congress. They have still time to act. And if not, to make sure that as soon as the new Congress is in place, which is on January 1st, not January 20th, that we move ahead, the House passed those four bills. We've got to get the Senate to do it. And I don't know if they have to be reintroduced, but we need this. The cancer of anti-Semitism continues to spread. It metastasizes on every level, in every sector. I meet CEOs who tell me what goes on in their own boardrooms. And these are Jewish CEOs at times, but also non-Jews who are really worried about what they see and how this is spreading. So time to act. Look at the courage of the president of Paraguay and others that we can emulate. Floyd Mayweather is a champ in many regards, not just because he won the boxing thing, but to stand up as he has. We have to do at least that much.
Thank you, Malcolm. Have a wonderful Shabbos. We'll speak again next week.
Shabbos be well.
Weekly update. Fridays, 7:40 a.m. Eastern Time here at JM in the AM. Don't forget that we are a listener-supported effort. If you have not yet given to our year-end campaign to support these types of programs and conversations, fjbunity.org, fjbunity.org. Let's end the week on a tremendous note, please.